to the 12th episode of Indestructible, Indestructible, Latin America with Rodrigo Acuña. This podcast is a collaborative effort between myself and Alborada, an independent voice on Latin American politics, media, and culture based in the United Kingdom. I am a contributing editor of Alborada and am based in Sydney, Australia. If you like the content of this podcast, please consider supporting us on Patreon. All of our patrons are now receiving a small selection of references to articles, podcasts, and books, which deal with some of the key topics discussed in each episode. In this episode, we examine Colombia and the recent first round of that country's presidential election. The runoff takes place on Sunday, the 19th of June. Plagued by decades of civil war and US interventionism, in 2016, the country saw a peace accord signed between the Colombian state and the Revolutionary Armed Forces of Colombia, FARC. In 2021, given wide discontent with rising poverty, given the harsh measures taken by the Duque administration during the COVID-19 pandemic, Colombia witnessed an explosion of social protest. With the demonstrations lasting over 2 months, by April, according to the Prosecutor General's office, some 80 protesters were reportedly killed, while human rights organizations noted that 300 people were disappeared. This year, during the presidential election, the left-wing coalition, Pacto Histórico, headed by the economist and ex-guerrilla Gustavo Petro, has won the first round ahead of right-wing candidate Rodolfo Hernández. The significance of such a victory for progressive forces in Colombia should not be overlooked. In order to make sense of these developments, in this episode, I spoke to Carlos Cruz Mosquera, who is a Colombian PhD candidate and teaching associate at Queen Mary University of London. He currently lives in the UK. I now leave you with Carlos Cruz Mosquera. Carlos Cruz Mosquera, thank you for joining us here at Indestructible Podcast. Last May 29th, Colombia witnessed the first round of its presidential elections. What were the results?
Okay, so the results were that the leftist candidate Gustavo Petro won with 40% of the vote, but they've had to go to the second round because he needed 50 plus 1% of the vote. So they're going to the second round, and the other candidate that has gone through is Rodolfo Hernández, who's a right wing, everybody describes him as a Trump kind of figure, who's a business tycoon, presents himself to be an anti-establishment kind of candidate, but really is part of the bourgeoisie, part of the ruling class, really. I guess the main news from the elections is that Uribismo that we've had for the past 20 years was defeated really in that election, which is a positive. But what's happened now is that the extreme right, the Uribistas, have gone with Rodolfo Hernández now backing him up, and it's foreseeable that all the Uribista votes, which is quite a large percentage of the vote, something like 5 million votes, will be going to Rodolfo Hernández, which makes it difficult for Gustavo Petro.
Could you tell us about Gustavo Petro and Francia Márquez, presidential and vice presidential progressive candidates of the historical pact coalition, as well as the right-wing candidate Rodolfo Hernández? What are some of the key policies of both of these candidates, and why have so many progressives in Colombia and in Latin America welcomed the victory of Petro and Márquez in the first round?
I would say that Petro's and Márquez's policies aren't that radical, really. They're not anti-capitalist. They've made that clear. At least Petro isn't. But I think the importance of Petro and Marquez's policies is that, you know, they're trying to bring about a political change where Colombians can finally participate democratically in the country without fear of being assassinated or disappeared or imprisoned and so on. You know, and I think that really is the importance of those candidates for Colombia. And, you know, I guess the reason why so many of the progressive circles in Latin America are, you know, looking forward to hopefully having the Pacto Histórico, the movement of these progressives in Colombia win on Sunday. And then Raúl Fernández, you know, as I was saying, he's a business tycoon. He is promising, you know, things. He's promising to quite progressive policies too. But what we've said is that there's no clear plan. So, you know, the difference between Petro and Hernández is that Petro has they've taken out a policy plan that you can read online, and it makes sense. You know, it's realistic, it's doable. Petro's quite an experienced politician. He's been in politics for, you know, the past 30, 40 years. Whereas Raúl Hernández is promising a lot, but has nothing to back it up. You know, it seems like it's just him. He doesn't really have an experienced team around him. And it's all verbal promises, you know, it's all things that, you know, we believe he can't really back up, and that we believe he's promising to the people so that they elect him. But then, you know, as we see with actual populists, you know, and they like to call Petro a populist too, because apparently he promises things. But the difference is that, as I've been saying, the policy's there, the plan is there to follow through. Whereas with Rodolfo, there's no plan. There's, you know, it's just empty promises, it seems. Mm-hmm.
How then are figures on the left like Gustavo Petro and Francia Márquez, and on the right, Rodolfo Hernández, connected to historical leaders or movements in Colombia on both the left, on both the right and the left of politics? Figures like, say, former president of Colombia, Álvaro Uribe, who you've mentioned, and who the DEA wants linked to the drug trade, and figures like Pablo Escobar.
So the question is how they're linked.
Both of the candidates,
Petro,
either ideologically or you know, more tangible links.
Okay, yeah. So Petro and Uribe, I guess their links are that they've been opponents, political opponents, really. Ever since Uribe came to power in 2002, shortly after, Petro started questioning him, you know, for his links with to the mafia, to the Colombian drug trade and cartels, as well as the paramilitaries, you know, these armed groups, you know, right-wing militias for the rich who go around taking people's lands or taking out left-wing leaders and social leaders, trade unionists and so on. And Petro really, for decades has been challenging him in Congress, you know, openly debating with him, openly, you know, showing evidence of Álvaro Uribe's links to criminality in Colombia. And so, yeah, you know, they couldn't be further apart from each other ideologically. You know, Uribe is, you know, as we know, is an extreme right-wing politician. And then Petro is, you know, for those who don't know who Petro is, he was part of the M19 guerrilla in the 70s and 80s, into the 90s, early 90s, who, again, you know, aren't a communist, weren't really an ideologically that radical, really. You know, we're talking about a guerrilla that was, you know, it's weird to say because it's not usually like, you know, middle class kind of liberal, actually, ideologically, many of the members of this guerrilla, but and that was what Petro was when he was part of that guerrilla. He and he still is, you know, he's pretty much, I would say, center left, and maybe you know, as I said before, he's not anti-capitalist, and you know, what he suggests is that, you know, you can take the capitalist system and reform it, and, you know, a kind of social democratic point of view. But yeah, as I say, the important thing is, well, yes, the material conditions could improve, you know, at least slightly. But most importantly, what Petro could bring is you know, the opening up of the democratic space in Colombia. Rodolfo Hernández and Uribe don't really have clear connections, you know, that you could point to. But in terms of, you know, there's no clear connection between them historically. But what you could say is that they form part of the same political class or the same economic class, the ruling class of Colombia. So and now Uribe has Uribe and his people and his movement have openly said that they will be backing Rodolfo and yeah, that's, they're basically campaigning for him.
Mm-hmm. In 2016, the Revolutionary Armed Forces of Colombia, FARC, signed a historic peace agreement with the Colombian state. As we have covered here at Indestructible Podcast in episode 3, in our interview with Mariela Cohen, the FARC have seen several hundred of its members murdered since 2016 in what some would argue is a clear sign that sections of the political right and the Colombian state are not upholding their end of the peace accords in allowing guerrillas to establish their own political party and integrate themselves back into society. Other failings, of course, include the lack of land reform as promised in 2016 accords. What is your interpretation of the peace accords and the guerrillas, and how is this issue, or how has this issue impacted the presidential elections?
I was in Colombia in 2016 when it was signed. You know, there was a lot of hope. Many of us hoped that the peace accords would, you know, we knew they weren't the solution. You know, it wasn't going to, you know, bring about an immediate change to the conditions of war and violence in the country. We knew that. But yeah, so you know, I could say, you know, I walked to the main plaza in Bogota, and young people, old people, you know, older generation of lefties were very hopeful. You know, it was a day that we were all longing for, really. Unfortunately, as you know, and as you know, Mariela spoke about this in the episode you had with her, unfortunately the implementation hasn't gone as we would have wanted. You know, we knew that the government, at least those of us who are, you know, quite critical of the Colombian state, and understand that, you know, it's an inherently corrupt institution, or inherently bourgeois institution. We knew that they weren't going to keep to their side of the deal, but we just didn't know to what extent, and really to, you know, they say something like it's been implemented to around 30% of, you know, so basically they have not kept their side of the deal. They, you know, ex-former guerrilla members are being killed left, right, and center. I'm not quite too sure of the figure now, but it's in the hundreds, you know. I guess you could. Oh, and also, you know, many of the ex-combatants have felt pressure to have to rejoin armed groups. You know, these are people who were supposedly were going to be given a chance to join society and given opportunities and so on. And instead, they have been persecuted for giving up their arms and killed and abandoned by the state and so on. So, you know, I think it's sad to say, but it's, you know, some of them rejoin in armed groups. I think you could, I know some people who, you know, were involved in the peace still, you know, talk down or talk badly about some of these ex-guerrilla members rejoining armed groups, but I think it's understandable. You know, when you're not given the guarantee that even the most basic guarantee of respecting your life, you know, I think it's justifiable. I think it's understandable that they would rejoin armed groups and so on, or even think, you know, to ideologically, you'd understand why they would think, you know, there's no point of even you know, having a civil relationship with the Colombian state. The other thing is that during the elections, I guess one of the important things that has come out and that we have seen during these elections, and I guess, you know, hasn't gone too well for the FARC, for the former FARC members, but something that has been positive is that during these elections, they haven't been able to use the FARC as a scapegoat anymore. So the right wing, the extreme right, the Uribistas, weren't able to, you know, scare people into voting for them because there's, you know, supposedly a menacing terrorist organization that you need protecting from. So that wasn't part of the debate. And you know, that is probably a big reason why Petro and Francia Márquez have done so well. Now you can actually talk about policies without, you know, people have to pay attention to policies beyond having to, beyond being scared to think that, you know, actually these might be good policies, but let's go with this right-wing candidate who's going to protect us, who's from the evil guerrilla. So you know, that's one of the positives, I guess. But yeah, you know, I have a personal relationship with some of the former guerrilla members. There's a group in Bogota called La Trocha, who are they're an independent brewery. So they make artisan beer, and that's, you know, that's one of the projects that they've developed to try and reincorporate themselves into society. And unfortunately, they have had to, you know, they've gotten very meager support from the state, and have had to, you know, reach out to people like me and others abroad to help them out financially and so on. And you know, we fundraised for them so that they can, you know, carry on their project and you know, make a decent life and a dignified living, where it just goes to show that the state isn't there, you know, as it is now, isn't there to you know, to achieve this peace that we all long for. They what they really wanted was to disarm dissidents so that they could have their you know, their capitalist neoliberal peace, so that they can exploit us and oppress us peacefully without arms, without the you know, a stone in their shoe, which was the FARC. So hopefully with Pedro and Francia Marquez, that, you know, actually hopefully coming to power on Sunday, we can see more of the peace accords implemented and people like the former guerrillas being given a proper opportunity to help us develop our society to a level where, you know, we can live in peace and where we can actually prosper economically and so on.
Mm-hmm. Writing recently in Counterpunch on the election, W.T. Whitney Jr., a retired pediatrician and political journalist, stated, and I quote, "Death threats greeting Pedro and Francia Marquez on the campaign trail forced them to cancel some events and deliver speeches from behind protective shields. Earlier popular mobilizations had also triggered ugly reactions." Commentators recalled the assassinations of four leftist or liberal presidential candidates between 1987 and 1990, and the murder of progressive presidential candidate Jorge Eliezer Gaitan on April 9th, 1948. Pedro and Gaitan are the only progressively orientated political figures in Colombia's history to have had realistic hopes of becoming president, end quote. My question is, what do you think are the possibilities that Colombia could relive a political scenario like the 1980s, where two progressive presidential candidates were murdered and the leftist political party, Patriotic Union, which saw several thousands of its members murdered by right-wing paramilitaries? What are the possibilities of, you know, the country descending back into violence?
I would say that, you know, I would say that the elites in Colombia are split. You know, some I'm sure would like to, and you know, most probably have planned to kill Gustavo Petro. You know, we have until Sunday. I hope nothing happens to him. But I think the other part, the elites in general, I think what we have moved towards now nowadays is not the physical killing. Although, you know, just a couple of weeks ago, Gustavo Petro did have to cancel part of his tour around the country because of a death threat. But what I think is more important is character assassination. That's what they've moved towards now, and what they're very good at is, you know, trying in the media and social media to assassinate Petro's character, and I think that's more of an effective way. And I'm sure that, you know, they would like to avoid something like what happened when Gaitan was killed, which is what triggered so much of the violence that we saw in Colombia. So yeah, I think, you know, they've moved towards that, and that's what we've seen in these elections, that they, you know, they take things out of context that Petro has said. And another thing that they've done is that they infiltrated Petro's campaign and did a video recording, an audio and video recording of their campaign strategy. And so there's a conversation, you know, between Petro's people where they're talking about their opponents and, you know, how they're going to defeat them. And you know, some of the things were quite harsh, what they were saying, but, you know, it not illegal or in any way, or and you know, things that you would see in any campaign strategy anywhere in the world. But they've taken this video and, you know, and they made it public, and they did it to, you know, to scare the public. They're like, look, they're willing to do the, you know, dirty politics. And so imagine them in power, imagine Petro in power, even though it wasn't Petro directly talking in the video, but, you know, it's the kind of dirty politics that the elites, the bourgeoisie in Colombia and all over the world really uses to you know, try and defeat their opponents. And a week before the elections, this video comes out. We saw it in Bolivia when I think it was a referendum, right? When there was some kind of referendum that Evo Morales had proposed. And I think it was like a month before that referendum, you know, the bourgeoisie got together and, you know, planned a character assassination of Evo Morales, claiming that he had this, you know, secret family and so on, which turned out to be all lies and false. But with 1 month to go to the referendum, it didn't matter whether it was false or not. The important thing was to, you know, to dirty his name, and they were successful because I think the referendum didn't turn out good for Evo Morales and MAS, the MAS party. So that's what they do, and that's what they're doing in Colombia. Another thing that they did recently was Petro's daughter did an interview with El País, the Spanish media outlet, where they took her words out of context. She said, you know, if Petro, my dad, doesn't get elected, you know, there might be protests and stuff. And, you know, what she was trying to say is, because the material conditions of the people are going to continue the same if this Rodolfo guy comes to power. So people will continue to protest and so on, which is understandable. But what the media is painting it to be is like, you know, oh, she's saying that, you know, these crazy lefties, if they don't win on Sunday, they're going to, you know, burn the cities and so on. So that's the kind of thing they do. You know, they're good at, in Colombia, they're good both at killing their opponents, lefty progressive opponents, but they're also good at dirtying their names. Piedad Córdoba is another politician that has been vilified by the Colombian state and by the Colombian media. She, you know, she's been questioned and so on about so many things, and it's increased during the elections and in the last leg of the elections, this vilification of Piedad Córdoba and other people around Petro has become more intense because they need to portray you know, the movement as being corrupt or as being criminal. You know, she was at an airport in Honduras, and you know, they found that she had some cash on her, and this was reported in Colombia as being, you know, the definitive proof that she's a corrupt politician because she had some cash on her, without properly, you know, looking into why she had that cash. You know, I believe she's a lawyer, and it's normal for her to carry around quite large amounts of money because of her clients pay her in cash and so on. So, you know, just things like that. And
you've published some excellent articles at Jacobin magazine, where you've been highly critical of the role of Britain and the EU that they've played in Colombia in propping up domestic elites who protect their economic interest in the country. For our listeners, could you elaborate on these relations?
Yeah, so, you know, why I argue, and actually what my research is based on, is how Europe and the West has oppressed Latin America, more particularly, obviously, Colombia is what I focus on. But yeah, you can see the roots of this unequal relationship, you know, going back to independence. You know, Colombia, very early on as a country, became a kind of, you know, became dominated by the West, economically, politically, and in every, you know, in every sense. Simón Bolívar once said something like, you know, the West had given them support, so they'd given them loans to fund the revolution. And then Bolívar said that was the biggest mistake that they had made, because it then meant that the country was basically owned by the West, and there was very little they could do about it. And so he said something like, you know, that those vultures won't be happy until they've taken everything, and you know, even our insides, our entrails, is what he said. And you know, so that's the history of Colombia. We've from since independence being at the mercy of the West. The United States has a very obvious role in Colombia, with military, you know, countless of military bases, and very clear support and assistance and so on for the government and for the state, you know, in order for the state to work in their interest and benefit. And then Europe has a much more subtle but equally impactful role in Colombia too. You know, they like to portray themselves as different to the US. They don't have military bases, but they do fund and help and train and support military and police forces in our country. You know, just last year during the strike, during the 3-month strike that we had in Colombia, it was discovered that the UK had been training the police just before the strikes happened. And so there's reason to believe that they were there to make sure that the police were sufficiently trained to suppress the political movement, the radical political movement in Colombia, so that they could protect their business interests and their geopolitical interests in Colombia. So and I'll give you another example. There's a thing that the European Union funded called Laboratorios de Paz, peace laboratories in Colombia, that was supposed to, it was painted to be a kind of response to Plan Colombia, which was like the military operation against dissidents, against the drug trade, and so on. And so the European Union said, no, you know what, we need peace laboratories where, you know, a society can come together and, you know, reconcile and so on. But then it was found that in practice, what they were actually doing was pacifying the people, depoliticizing the people, dividing left-wing groups, dividing grassroots social organizations, and so on. So yeah, you know, there's the good cop, bad cop kind of thing. The bad cop is the US with the overtly military violence, and the good cop is you know, supposedly the European Union. But in reality, what they do is very much of the same thing. You know, look out for the capitalist and neoliberal interests.
In one of your articles in Jacobin earlier this year, you wrote, and I quote, "In 2017, the conflict-ridden nation became NATO's first Latin American partner. This move was justified on the basis of security cooperation. More recently, to ward off supposed Chinese and Russian influence, US right-wing Congressman Marco Rubio and Bob Menendez proposed further consolidated military cooperation with Latin America. Weeks later, Colombia signed the US-Colombia Strategic Alliance Act, one of the many aims of which was the provision of additional benefits in the areas of defense, trade, and security cooperation. Could you tell us more about Colombia's relationship with NATO, which stands for the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, and the US-Colombia Strategic Alliance Act, which you made reference to in your piece?
Yeah, so you know, the same thing as usual. The US, the West, has always had a military influence in Colombia, and it goes, you know, it goes both ways. They come and you know, and support the Colombian elites in their military projects to fight back dissidents and revolutionary movements and social leaders and so on. you know, always quoted also as if it was like a, you know, military operations against the drug trade and the bad guys, you know, the guerrillas who are, you know, now involved in the drug trade. And, you know, it's a thing that's questionable. But yeah, so they've always had this relationship. They, for example, Colombia, when the protests exploded in Colombia after Jorge Eliezer Gaitan was killed, the US very quickly sent advisors, military advisors, to train and to support the Colombia's elites in fighting back the protests and in counterinsurgency tactics that were violent and horrible. Like, for example, napalm, which is, you know, we know that the US used napalm in Vietnam, but actually even before they used it in Vietnam, they had a operation in Colombia where they used napalm on revolutionary guerrilla fighters. This was through cooperation, US Colombian military cooperation. So you know, the West has always had a military involvement in Colombia, and Colombia has also, unfortunately, we have been used in Western imperialist wars elsewhere, like in Korea. Colombia was the only Latin American country to have sent troops to Korea during the Korean War, which is ridiculous. But yeah, more recently, as you've said, Colombia became a global partner to NATO in 2017. And ever since then, they've been, you know, tightening their relationship and using the Colombian military for their own interests and for their own, and the Colombian elites obviously allow this. There's a recent program, a NATO program in Colombia called the NATO Defense Education Enhancement Program, where they do things like, you know, this is the words that they use, is enhancing the curriculum and English training for military schools in Colombia. And we know what that means. You know, it means training the Colombian military to quash rebellions and to, you know, to really act in the interest of capital and international capital, and then you have also the Colombian government, Duque's, Iván Duque, the current government, when the war in Ukraine started, Iván Duque said, you know, we're ready to send troops if needed, if, you know, if NATO and so on are going to fight back the Russians, we're ready too. So, you know, we're really just, you know, the Colombian government are dogs for the Western imperialists, unfortunately.
Looking at broader political developments in Latin America in recent years, it's obvious the left and progressive forces have made a comeback in countries like Mexico, Bolivia, and to some extent, even in Chile. Mexico, under the government of Andrés Manuel López Obrador in particular, has in recent years made its presence felt by critiquing US foreign policy towards Latin America on several fronts, like its economic sanctions on Cuba and Venezuela. And of course, Andrés Manuel López Obrador did not attend the recent 9th Summit of the Americas in Los Angeles. How do you think these developments could support or hinder progressive politics inside Colombia?
I think it's super important what AMLO is doing, as well as other leaders in Latin America. for example, in the summit, in the Americas summit that just happened in Los Angeles, you saw so many of the leaders of Latin America and the Caribbean speak out against U.S. aggression, U.S. exclusion of progressive and lefty countries. So, you know, with all of the things that you could question, and, you know, I'd say it's important to to hold AMLO and others, you know, accountable for some of the things that happen in the countries. Also, you know, what I like to always say and qualify is that understand that, you know, even though AMLO's in power, he doesn't necessarily control the state, and his movement doesn't control the state, and so some of the things that happen is not necessarily down to him, down to his own policies, but just the structure, the structure of the state that really is what we need to also change, not just the presidents and not just the governments, but yeah, what, you know, in terms of what they're doing internationally, like sticking up, strengthening the ties in the region with countries like Cuba, Venezuela, who have been historically shunned by the US and their allies in our region, you know, is super important, and so much so that even in the Rodolfo Hernandez, the right wing candidate in Colombia, has said he looks up to AMLO, you know, which is, you know, with all of the, you know, we with all of our hope that he doesn't come to power, at least there's, you know, some glimpse of the impact that AMLO's having on not just AMLO but other leaders in the region are having on everyone, really, and showing that we can be a dignified region where we can think for ourselves, where we don't have to necessarily follow, where we don't have to follow the orders of the US. You know, in my opinion, is really beautiful to see.
Now, finally, taking a broader historical view, why do you think Colombian elites have been so recalcitrant in allowing progressive forces to establish trade unions and political parties that could broaden democracy? Why has Colombia seen so many decades of civil war, which ended only recently? And what are some of the key points about Colombian politics you think people outside the country should be made aware of?
The first part of that, I would say, I recently wrote a piece for Tribune where I say, you know, why Colombia is important to the West, you know, and not taken away from the internal conditions that have strengthened the elites. But also we have to understand that there's a context to that. And the context, I think, you know, we have to say that it's due to imperialism. The US and the West have historically had an interest in making sure that Colombia does not sway away from their influence, and because of that, that's why they've paid so much attention and they've made sure that they're always at the side of the Colombian government, at the side of the Colombian state, making sure that they don't sway from the sphere of influence, and I think that's the strength of the elites in Colombia. It's really due to foreign meddling. If we had been allowed, you know, from the time of when they killed Jorge Díaz del Gaitán, I think without foreign meddling, without the support that the Colombian elites and the military arm without the support they've received from the West, we could have, in my opinion, organically been able to, bring about a more democratic and you know, I'd say socialist or at least socialist leaning governments. So yeah, I'd say it's because the Western imperialism hasn't allowed that to happen, and that's why Petro is a threat. I don't think the Western influence will immediately change with Petro, but I think is the beginning. It could be the beginning of us, doing hopefully something like what AMLO is doing. You know, having some dignity and being like, you know what, we can think for ourselves. We can come up with policies that aren't about benefiting the national and international elites that have historically governed us. And then the second part of that was political stuff from Colombia that people should know about. You know, we in Colombia, even though our governments, I've said recently that we've never had a leftist government in Colombia. So with Petro, it would be the first. It's important to understand that even though we are seen as such a right-wing country, it's the government, but the people, the movement of dissidents, of revolutionaries has always been very strong with the guerrillas, with the social movements, political leaders. That's something that people should be aware of. Like we, even though we are controlled by a Western-backed, powerful elite in our country, the people have never just sat down and crossed their arms and you know allowed them to free reign. I think we've always, you know, I think you could say that Colombian people are a people who are who are willing, who have sacrificed so many of our people have sacrificed themselves to bring about change for our country and for the region, but it hasn't been possible up until hopefully this Sunday when Gustavo Petro and Francia Márquez come to power and at least start going in the right direction. We're just talking about AMLO, and our hope is that there is something like that. You know, we understand that there's not going to be an immediate change, but we hope that this is the beginning, the first step towards more progressive and ultimately hopefully radical politics where we where we head towards socialism is the hope for many of us. And is what people have been fighting for in Colombia, you could say for centuries. You know, the people have always there's been a strong movement to a strong socialist and revolutionary movement in Colombia, not just the guerrillas, but political movements, social movements, the black communities, black and indigenous communities that have always resisted the status quo of the elites, the ruling class, those are the communities that people should that don't know about Colombian politics should find out about. I published a paper on an indigenous guy called Jose Gonzalo Sanchez, who was actually one of the founders of the Communist Party in Colombia, and that nobody really speaks of, and nobody, you know, apart from, you know, a small circle of academics and historians and so on that might look into the history, but in the mainstream, Jose Gonzalo Sanchez has been, you know, historically forgotten, and, you know, that's, another just one character that we can look into and who had such a huge impact on the social and political movement in Colombia.
Carlos Cruz Mosquera, a Colombian PhD candidate and teaching associate at Queen Mary University of London, who currently lives in London. Thank you very much for speaking to us here at Indestructible Podcast on the upcoming second round of the presidential elections in Colombia.
Thank you so much, Rodrigo.
As always, I would like to thank Alborada for this opportunity to host Indestructible, Indestructible. Once again, I would encourage our listeners to support this podcast on Patreon, which you can do for as little as the price of one cup of coffee a month. My sincere thanks, as always, goes to Alborada's founder and co-editor, Pablo Navarrete, who produces this podcast. If you have any feedback on this episode, please write to us on our email, which you will find on the Alborada website. We'll be back soon with episode 13, but until then, goodbye and stay safe. Indestructible.